The reason for this was simple. The vast majority of the public accepted the legend as fact, and even those skeptics who were disposed to test its truth had no facts with which to make the test, because the records of Triborough and the mouths of its ministers were so effectively sealed. If, however, they had been able to see the records and open the mouths, they would have learned that the legend was a gigantic hoax. Prudent? Efficient? Economical? So incredibly wasteful was Moses of the money he tolled from the public in quarters and dimes that on a single bridge alone he paid $40 million more in interest than he had to. Authority projects cost the taxpayers nothing. Covert loans made to authorities by the state, loans designed never to be repaid, ran into the hundreds of millions of dollars. The cost of city-purchased land on which authority facilities were built ran into the hundreds of millions. The cost of taxpayer-financed toll roads leading to authority facilities ran into the billions. And the loss in tax revenue because authority-controlled land was removed from the tax rolls drained the city year after year. Most important, had the records of the authorities been open, they would have disproved another aspect of the lie, the legend that Robert Moses was no politician, that he operated at a higher level than that implied in the derogatory connotations attached to that noun, that he managed to create his public works at a remove from politics. Actually, as these records prove, Robert Moses' authorities were a political machine oiled by the lubricant of political machines, money. Their wealth enabled Moses to make himself not only a political boss, but a boss who in his particular bailiwick, public works, was able to exert a power that few political bosses in the more conventional mold ever attain. Even had the records been available, of course, the public might not have understood their significance. For Moses was a political boss with a difference. He was not the stereotype with which Americans were familiar. His constituency was not the public, but some of the most powerful men in the city and state. And he kept these men in line by doling out to them, as Tammany ward bosses once handed out turkeys to the poor at Thanksgiving, the goodies in which such men were interested. The sugar plums of public relations retainers, insurance commissions, and legal fees. This man, personally honest in matters of money, became the locus of corruption in New York City. Robert Moses made himself the ward boss of the inner circle, the bankroller of the 400 of politics. Far from being above the seamier aspects of politics, he was, for decades, the central figure about whom revolved much of the backstage maneuvering of New York City politics. Triborough's public relations retainers ran to $250,000 a year, its legal fees to $250,000, its insurance commissions to $500,000, a total of $1 million a year. Moses parceled out retainers, fees, and commissions to city and state political leaders on the basis of a very exact appraisal of their place in the political pecking order. And an examination of the records of the recipients leads to the conclusion that, year after year, it was the men who received Moses' turkey baskets who fought against any diminution in Moses' power and for whatever public works project he was pushing at the moment. Beyond graft and patronage, moreover, Moses also displayed a genius for using the wealth of his public authorities to unite behind his aims banks, labor unions, contractors, bond underwriters, insurance firms, the great retail stores, real estate manipulators, all the forces which enjoy immense behind-the-scenes political influence in New York. He succeeded in mobilizing behind his banner economic forces with sufficient weight to bend to his aims the apparatus so carefully established in city charter and state constitution to ensure that, in deciding on such projects, the decisive voice would be that of the people. He used economic power for political ends, so successfully that in the fields he carved out for his own, fields in which decisions would shape the city's future for generations, if not for centuries, he made economic, not democratic forces, the forces that counted in New York. And because he spoke for such forces, it was his voice that counted most of all. He gave everybody involved in the political setup in this city whatever it was that they wanted, one official recalls. Therefore, they all had their own interest in seeing him succeed. The pressure that this interest all added up to was a pressure that no one in the system could stand up against because it came from the system itself. And since the mayor's power and career rested on this system, he was as helpless to stand against the pressure Moses could exert as was anyone else. When Robert Moses walked into Wagner's office on that inauguration day in City Hall and shoved the appointment blank across Wagner's desk, Wagner had no choice but to sign it. Given the circumstances of the Democratic Party in New York City, he couldn't let Robert Moses resign. What Moses had succeeded in doing, really, was to replace graft with benefits that could be derived with legality from a public works project. He had succeeded in centralizing in his projects, and to a remarkable extent in his own person, all those forces which are not in theory supposed to, but which in practice do, play a decisive role in political decisions. Corruption before Moses had been unorganized, based on a multitude of selfish private ends. Moses' genius for organizing it and focusing it at a central source gave it a new force, a force so powerful that it bent the entire city government off the democratic bias. He had used the power of money to undermine the democratic processes of the largest city in the world, to plan and build its parks, bridges, highways, and housing projects on the basis of his whim alone. In the beginning, and for decades of his career, the power Robert Moses amassed was the servant of his dreams, amassed for their sake, so that his gigantic city-shaping visions could become reality. But power is not an instrument that its possessor can use with impunity. It is a drug that creates in the user a need for larger and larger dosages. And Moses was a user. At first, for a decade or more after his first sip of real power in 1924, he continued to seek it only for the sake of his dreams. But little by little, there came a change. Slowly but inexorably, he began to seek power for its own sake. More and more, the criterion by which Moses selected which city-shaping public works would be built came to be not the needs of the city's people, but the increment of power a project could give him. Increasingly, the projects became not ends, but means, the means of obtaining more and more power. As the idealism faded and disappeared, its handmaidens drifted away. The principles of the good government reform movement, which Moses had once espoused, became principles to be ignored. The brilliance that had invented a civil service system was applied to the task of circumventing civil service requirements. The insistence on truth and logic was replaced by a sophistry that twisted every fact to conclusions not merely preconceived, but preconceived decades earlier. Robert Moses was America's greatest builder. He was the shaper of the greatest city in the New World. But what did he build? What was the shape into which he pounded the city? To build his highways, Moses threw out of their homes 250,000 persons, more people than lived in Albany or Chattanooga or in Spokane, Tacoma, Duluth, Akron, Baton Rouge, Mobile, Nashville, or Sacramento. He tore out the hearts of a score of neighborhoods, communities the size of small cities themselves, communities that had been lively, friendly places to live, the vital parts of the city that made New York a home to its people. By building his highways, Moses flooded the city with cars. By systematically starving the subways and the suburban commuter railroads, he swelled that flood to city-destroying dimensions. By making sure that the vast suburbs, rural and empty when he came to power, were filled on a sprawling, low-density development pattern relying primarily on roads instead of mass transportation, he ensured that the flood would continue for generations, if not centuries, that the New York metropolitan area would be, perhaps forever, an area in which transportation, getting from one place to another, would be an irritating, life-consuming concern for its 14 million residents. For highways, Moses dispossessed 250,000 persons. For his other projects, Lincoln Center, the United Nations, the Fordham, Pratt, and Long Island University campuses, a dozen mammoth urban renewal projects, he dispossessed tens of thousands more. There are available no accurate figures on the total number of people evicted from their homes for all Robert Moses' public works, but the figure is almost certainly close to 500,000. The one detailed study by an outside agency shows that in a 10-year period, 1946 to 1956, the number was 320,000. More significant even than the number of the dispossessed were their characteristics. A disproportionate share of them were black, Puerto Rican, and poor. He evicted tens of thousands of poor, non-white persons for urban renewal projects, and the housing he built to replace the housing he tore down was to an overwhelming extent not housing for the poor, but for the rich. The dispossessed, barred from many areas of the city by their color and their poverty, had no place to go but into the already overcrowded slums, or into soft borderline areas that then became slums, so that his slum clearance programs created new slums as fast as they were clearing the old. When he built housing for poor people, he built housing bleak, sterile, cheap, expressive of patronizing condescension in every line. And he built it in locations that contributed to the ghettoization of the city, dividing up the city by color and income. And by skewing city expenditures toward revenue-producing services, he prevented the city from reaching out toward its poor and assimilating them, and teaching them how to live in such housing. And the very people for whom he built it reacted with rage and bitterness and ignorance and defaced it. He built parks and playgrounds with a lavish hand, but they were parks and playgrounds for the rich and the comfortable. Recreational facilities for the poor he doled out like a miser. For decades, to advance his own purposes, he systematically defeated every attempt to create the master plan that might have enabled the city to develop on a rational, logical, unified pattern. Defeated it until, when it was finally adopted, it was too late for it to do much good. One must wait until the evening. In the evening of Robert Moses' 44 years of power, New York, so bright with promise 44 years before, was a city in chaos and despair. His highways and bridges and tunnels were awesome, taken as a whole the most awesome urban improvement in the history of mankind. But no aspect of those highways and bridges and tunnels was as awesome as the congestion on them. He had built more housing than any public official in history, but the city was starved for housing, more starved, if possible, than when he had started building, and the people who lived in that housing hated it, James Baldwin could write, almost as much as the policeman, and this is saying a great deal. He had built great monuments and great parks, but people were afraid to travel to or walk around them. For all these reasons, this book attempts to tell two stories at once. How New York, 40 years ago a very different city from the city it is today, became what it has become, and how the idealistic Robert Moses became what he has become. It must try to be a book about what happened to the city and what happened to the man. For, to an extent few people have really understood, these two stories are one story. Would New York have been a better place to live if Robert Moses had never built anything? Would it have been a better city if the man who shaped it had never lived? Any critic who says so ignores the fact that both before and after Robert Moses, both under reform mayors such as John Peroy Mitchell and John V. Lindsay, and under Tammany mayors such as Red Mike Hyland and Jimmy Walker, the city was utterly unable to meet the needs of its people in areas requiring physical construction. Robert Moses may have bent the democratic processes of the city to his own ends to build public works. Left to themselves, these processes proved unequal to the building required. The problem of constructing large-scale public works in a crowded urban setting, where such works impinge on the lives of or displace thousands of voters, is one which democracy has not yet solved. Moses himself, who feels his works will make him immortal, believes he will be justified by history, that his works will endure and be blessed by generations not yet born. Perhaps he is right. It is impossible to say that New York would have been a better city if Robert Moses had never lived. It is possible to say only that it would have been a different city. Part 1. The Idealist. Chapter 1. Line of Succession. Robert Moses was born on December 18, 1888. He was not given a middle name because his mother saw no reason for one. Bella Moses was a strong-willed woman, so strong-willed, in fact, that some of her relatives said she was too much like her mother and not enough like her father. Bella's parents, Robert's grandparents, were first cousins. Both had been born, Bernard Cohen in 1821, Rosalie Silverman 5 years later, in the small Bavarian village of Reckendorf to struggling merchant families, two of the tens of thousands of German-Jewish families made highly susceptible to American fever by laws that segregated them in crowded Judengassen and forced them to pay the humiliating Jew toll whenever they made a trip away from the ghetto. The statutes also prohibited Jews from owning any land except that on which their houses stood, or from dealing in any goods that could not be carried with them. Bavaria, where German antisemitism was most virulent, had even set a limit on the number of Jewish marriages in an attempt to keep the Jewish population down. The Silvermans left Reckendorf for New York while Rosalie was in her teens. Bernard Cohen had been taken to Frankfurt am Main as a child by parents who hoped that life for Jews in Germany would be better outside Bavaria. When this hope was dashed, they waited until Bernard was 21 and then sent him and a younger brother, Samuel, to America, where the brothers opened a small dry goods store in Mobile, Alabama. In 1848, they moved to New York, rented a small office, and became dry goods importers. Bernard met his cousin, and in 1849, they were married. Business prospered, and the Cohen brothers branched out into real estate with such success that they were soon considered millionaires. Their father had been able to send them to America with a little cash in their pockets, so they had never suffered the desperate poverty that had afflicted other German-Jewish immigrants of the 1840s. The brothers Seligman, Abraham Kuhn, Simon Guggenheim, and his son Meyer, for instance, who, without enough capital to open stores, had had to earn it trudging through rural Pennsylvania with heavy packs on their backs and sticks in their hands to ward off dogs, peddling merchandise from farmhouse to farmhouse. Perhaps for this reason, the brothers, Bernard in particular, never displayed the lifelong preoccupation with wealth that flogged the one-time peddlers along a gyre of financial expansion that eventually made them merchant princes, international bankers, and mining tycoons, men whom Cleveland Amory labeled the Jewish Grand Dukes, who were not part of the 400, but rather of their own 100, and who created in New York City their own self-contained society that was known among themselves as Our Crowd. By the time he was 50, Bernard, security assured, was leaving business affairs largely in Samuel's hands and taking an interest, unusual among Jewish businessmen in New York in the 1870s, in civic affairs. Becoming convinced of slum residents' need for more breathing space, he launched a successful campaign to persuade the city fathers, who were not at all sure that they hadn't already made a gigantic mistake by removing a huge hunk of land from the tax rolls to create Central Park, to set aside other, smaller areas for more parks. Among his friends, he gained a reputation as an incisive and visionary analyst of social problems. In 1875, Joseph Seligman resigned from the traditional Jewish seat on the city school commission, and Mayor William H. Wickham appointed a non-Jew to fill the vacancy. The German-Jewish community was outraged. "We want the unsectarian character of our public schools preserved," editorialized the Jewish Times. We do not want to be delivered into the hands of disguised missionaries in the persons of principals who smuggle in sectarian prayers and hymns in our public schools. The German Jews decided to unite behind a single man and insist on his appointment to the commission, and the man they chose was Bernard Cohen, who was appointed in January 1877. If not one of the richer or more famous members of our crowd, he was one of the most respected. Yet, within the circle of his family, Cohen was almost pitied. His grandchildren, years after his death, remembered him as a tall, slim man, handsome, with an aquiline nose and pale blue eyes. They recalled that he was generous, very gentle and mild, a little absent-minded, and so unfailingly courteous in manner that when he visited his granddaughters, he would kiss their hands rather than their faces. But what they recalled most vividly about Bernard Cohen was how unmercifully he was bullied by his wife. "My grandmother had the reputation of being as hard as nails," one says. "She had that reputation because of the way she treated her husband." Rosalie Silverman had been a beautiful girl, tall, statuesque, with a whiteness of skin that made her black hair and full red lips all the more striking. She aged early, however, and she aged hard, becoming terribly wrinkled and gaunt, her eyes sunken, her long, thin nose jutting out sharply from the wrinkles. Only her hair remained youthful, and the fact that it stayed jet black until her death at the age of 93 led her family to believe she dyed it. She bore 5 children, Bella, 3 other girls, and a son, David. But she was not the stereotype Jewish mother. In fact, when 2 of the girls, Emma, who had married banker Adolf Oppenheim, and Lydia, wife of Kuhn Loeb & Company partner Abraham Wolf, became fatally ill while still in their 20s, wasting away for months before they died, it was Bernard, not Rosalie, who visited them every day and helped with the nursing. Rosalie, a relative recalls, seemed to want to forget about them. Rosalie's bent was intellectual rather than maternal. She was a voracious reader of philosophy and history, as well as fiction. Her hobby was crossword puzzles, and she made a practice of racing through several of them every day in both English and German newspapers. A sharp mind was coupled with a sharp tongue, which she used on those who disagreed with her opinions. And she was unusually frank for a Jewish or Gentile housewife of her era. Once one of her granddaughters was amazed to realize that old Granny Cohen was about to give her an unsolicited lecture on sex. "One must be very much in love to enjoy it," old Granny began, and she proceeded, with none of the delicacy ladies usually attach to such discussions at the turn of the century. With underlings, Granny Cohen was flashingly imperious. After her husband died, she moved with her maid Susan into a suite in the fashionable Windsor Hotel on Fifth Avenue between 46th and 47th Streets and sent out invitations to a sweet-warming luncheon. On the day before the luncheon, she decided she didn't like the chandelier in her living room. Marching down to the front desk, she ordered a new chandelier, told the clerk it must be installed by the following day at 10 a.m., cut off his protestations with a curt, "I won't take no for an answer," and swept out the door without waiting for a reply. Granny Cohen's definition of underlings, moreover, apparently included the general public. When buying tickets for a railroad trip or a play, her practice was to eye the queue of ticket buyers disdainfully and then stride up to the first man on it and simply elbow him out of the way. And the definition appeared to include her husband. "The way Granny Cohen treated Grandfather Cohen was quite striking," the granddaughter recalls. "She absolutely sat on him." Many of the more intellectual members of our crowd became impressed during the 1870s with the philosophy of a German rabbi's son named Felix Adler, who was talking about substituting ethics for religious piety. Rosalie Cohen became one of Adler's most enthusiastic supporters. When the Society for Ethical Culture was formed in 1876, with Joseph Seligman as its first president, she became a member, and so did Bernard Cohen, who previously had been one of the most devout members of Temple Emmanuel, the stronghold of Reform Jewry in New York. On May 13, 1897, after absent-mindedly taking a walk in the rain without an umbrella, Bernard caught pneumonia and 4 days later died. His funeral services were conducted by Dr. Adler. Old age did not change Granny Cohen. In her 90s, she still walked almost every day to public and lending libraries to obtain books, and Robert's college friends who were present when she dropped in on the Moses family were astonished at the range of her knowledge. In summers, at the Moses summer home at Lake Placid, she would arise early, open an imposing stack of German and English language newspapers to their crossword puzzles, sit down on a porch overlooking the lake, and begin working on puzzles in two languages. Within an hour, she would be back inside, chatting with the college boys animatedly about the latest trends in art or science, and one of the boys, happening to glance through the pile of papers she had left on the porch, noticed that every word of every puzzle was completed. Age certainly did not wither her independence. Until she died, she did her own marketing every day. She refused to allow herself to be examined by doctors, even by her grandson Nathan E. Brill, an official of Mount Sinai Hospital and discoverer of Brill's disease, a form of typhus fever. And, despite the entreaties of her children, she would not allow the bell pull in her hotel room to be moved from the door to a spot near her bed so that she could summon Susan more easily in case of emergency. "I'll never be too sick to walk across the room," she said. In fact, although she became very hard of hearing, she was seldom sick at all, until a night in July 1919, a month after her 93rd birthday. On that evening, she went to bed with a German crossword puzzle. At midnight, with the puzzle almost completed, she arose, walked across the room, rang the bell pull, and, when the maid arrived, said calmly, "Susan, call Dr. Brill. I'm dying." When Dr. Brill arrived, she was dead. The striking features that had been Rosalie's portion as a girl were passed on to her son and three oldest daughters, all of whom were considered to have made good marriages. Looks ran high in the Cohen family, friends say. But Rosalie's youngest daughter, Bella, she never used her real name, Isabella, was a slim girl and young woman of less than medium height, whose features, except for a too prominent, rather high-bridged nose, were, under brown curly hair, exceedingly plain. So were her clothes. Unlike her mother, Bella had a quiet, unassuming manner that combined with her slimness and curls to give her the appearance, even in her 20s, of a sweet little girl. She also possessed a kindliness that is not remembered as one of Rosalie's most noticeable attributes. Bella was always doing nice things for people, little thoughtful things, recalls one of her cousins, Hilda Hellman. When Hilda's young son Jeffrey broke a leg in an automobile accident and had to spend time in Mount Sinai, he could be sure of an almost daily visit, and present, from his Aunt Bella. Nevertheless, of Rosalie's five children, Bella was the one most like her mother. If her looks weren't as impressive, her mind was. Educated by private tutors and then at Charlier, the exclusive finishing school, she could speak both French and German fluently and had a wide acquaintance with the literature of both countries. And if her appearance was that of a quiet and sweet little girl, quite different from her mother, people who bothered to talk to the little girl found that the appearance was deceiving. In discussing her opinions, Bella was mannerly and soft-spoken, but the opinions delivered in that soft voice were direct, forceful, and not particularly susceptible to alteration. In fact, people who tried to alter them came to realize rather quickly that while Bella's voice was soft, the things she might say with it could be sharp indeed. "After you had talked to her," recalls an acquaintance, "you began to observe her more closely, and it didn't take you long to realize that under that quiet manner was an astonishing amount of arrogance. She was her mother's daughter." In 1886, at the age of 26, Bella married Emmanuel Moses, a 35-year-old department store owner from New Haven. He was a tall, dark, shaggy man with warm, kindly eyes, a soft mustache, and a gentle, slow manner. Born in Cologne, of a family in which mingled blood of both German Jews and Sephardic Jews from Seville, he had started out in America as a lace merchant, and then had opened a little department store in New Haven and built it into a successful business. But he was too slow and quiet for the Cohens. They felt that Bella had not made a very good marriage in comparison with her sisters. They felt, in fact, that Bella had married beneath her. Emmanuel and Bella moved to New Haven, which in 1886 was a quiet, charming little town celebrated for its elm-lined streets, a meticulously manicured 16-acre central green, and beautiful public buildings and parks. They settled down in 83 Dwight Street, a big, rambling house with a broad, shaded porch and a generous helping of the gingerbread that characterized the architecture of the period, and it was in that house that their three children were born, Paul Emmanuel in 1887, Robert in 1888, and Edna Marion in 1891. Dwight Street, two blocks from the Yale University campus, was a wide, sleepy, dirt street shaded by some of the biggest of New Haven's elms. The houses along it were substantial, if not elegant, and they were built close to the wooden sidewalk, so that most of the big lots consisted of back yards. And in those yards, because the families on the street were well-off manufacturers and businessmen, were well-tended grape arbors and stables, and inside the stables were horses and carriages. The numerous children of Dwight Street rode up and down the street on those horses, with coachmen or house servants leading them and carefully holding them in to a walk, and played on the shady porches or in the spacious backyards under the tall trees, and there were so many servants in the big houses that mothers didn't scold if boys like Mr. Paul or Mr. Robert, who slept in the same bedroom on the second floor of number 83, got their Eton collars and little Lord Fauntleroy suits dirty. To the end of their lives, the three Moses children would remember New Haven with fondness. Searching for an adjective to describe Dwight Street, Robert Moses would say, comfortable. Paul would say, shady, well-kept, nice. If the Moses children were happy in New Haven, so was their father. His department store was prospering, and he had begun to buy up property in the city, including the Chamber of Commerce building on Temple Street. But Bella disliked New Haven. She felt there was no cultural activity there worth talking about, and she felt she was many cuts above the run of the local matrons. In 1897, the Moses family moved to New York. Many years later, Robert Moses would say, "I didn't like New York at all. It was too big. The crowds, the noise, and the confusion were terrible. I wanted to go back to New Haven, to go to Yale, and to become governor of Connecticut. I felt that way all during my years in New York." Emmanuel Moses never let anyone know how he felt. In order to move, he had to sell his store and his real estate holdings. In 1897, he was 46 years old, a businessman who had achieved success and who had seemed to be heading for more. Moreover, he had liked running his store. He was a businessman who enjoyed being in business. He was to spend the rest of his life in retirement. In New York, Bella found a cause. It was the settlement house movement. In 1897, the year the Moses family moved from New Haven, hundreds of thousands of Eastern European Jews, who had been working 18 hours a day for a wage of 2 or 3 rubles a week, formed Der Allgemeiner Jiddischer Arbeiterbund, the General League of Jewish Workers, in Russia, Poland, and Lithuania, in a last, despairing, foredoomed attempt to improve their lot, which was even harder than that which German Jews like the Cohens and Silvermans had fled a half century earlier. In Tsarist Russia, the vast ghetto known as the Pale of Settlement had become a morass of the most bitter poverty. The virtual legalization of discrimination in the May laws of the 1880s had touched off a series of savage pogroms. When the strikes called by the cobblers, tailors, and weavers who had formed the General League were broken by bloodshed, imprisonment, and torture, the Jews of Eastern Europe felt that their only hope was escape to America. They poured into New York at a rate of 90,000 a year. By 1907, there would be close to 1 million Jews in the city. By 1915, 1.5 million, 28% of its population. Eastern European Jews arrived in the New World scarred by the lash and the knout, idealistic and socialistic, and dirt poor. Families were shoehorned into blocks of railroad flats, while fathers used their meager savings to stock pushcarts and learned, all too slowly, that peddling, which had worked so well for the Seligmans, Guggenheims, and Kuhns, was no longer the path to riches in America. To aid these immigrants, the Lower East Side settlement houses sprang up, funded and staffed largely by New York's established German-Jewish community. And Bella Moses, newly returned to New York, soon became an enthusiastic funder and staffer. She worked first at the famous Henry Street settlement, but soon transferred her allegiance to Madison House, one of the smallest and newest of the settlement houses, and therefore one in which she could play a more prominent role. Two characteristics of Bella's work for Madison House, which was to continue for more than 30 years, soon became apparent. One was a characteristic shared by many of the German Jews who traveled down to the Lower East Side in carriage and cab from the servanted enclave around Temple Emmanuel. It was a characteristic that moved one of their chroniclers to call their philanthropy something very close to patronage. For while the motives which impelled the rich Jews to help the poor Jews were certainly in part manifestations of tzedakah, the religious principle of charity, historians have also found other motives. They have found that many German Jews, solid, respectable, Americanized, were embarrassed by the gruff, uncouth, shaggy-bearded, conspicuously un-Americanized newcomers. Those people, the Germans felt, were loud, pushy, aggressive, the dregs of Europe. They spoke of them in terms others applied to the Yellow Peril, the German-Jewish press lamenting the un-American ways of the wild Asiatics. The German Jews even coined a word for their co-religionists, a word based on the fact that many Russian names ended in ki. The word was kikes. Yet, despite their efforts to make clear the difference between themselves and the newcomers, they realized that non-Jews were lumping them all together, taking the behavior of the newcomers as the stereotype by which they thought of all Jews. The solution, many German Jews felt, was to make the shabby immigrants respectable, to clean them up, dust them off, and teach them to act like Americans. For this reason, the early settlement houses, while working tirelessly to give the newcomers a better life, to provide free lodging, meals, and medical care, also emphasized lectures on manners, morals, and the dangers of socialism. Many German Jews seemed to feel, as one commentator put it, as if they were assuming the white man's burden. Their philanthropy was that of patron lords doling out funds to the poor, the miserable, the dependent, and the patronized. If this description was to some extent true of the movement as a whole, it was to a great extent true of Madison House, whose official history says it was established to help in the Americanization of residents of the Lower East Side. And to some of her relatives, the description fitted Bella's philanthropy. Undoubtedly, there ran through her work a strain of genuine idealism. Deeply moved by the plight of the slum residents she met at Madison, she talked of helping the lower classes in terms of a holy crusade. Public service, service such as Madison House was furnishing, was a phrase which came more and more frequently to her lips, and she said public service was a cause to which one could happily devote one's life. But she also never forgot that the lower classes were lower. Recalls one relative, her attitude to these people was, "You're my children, I know best. You do what I tell you, and I'll take care of you." Rosalie Silverman Cohen began to refer to her daughter derisively as Lady Bountiful. The other characteristic of Bella's work for Madison House was one much rarer among the platoons of wealthy German-Jewish matrons on the boards of trustees of the settlement houses. Bella, graying now and often spectacled, could have passed for one of these matrons, although her clothes were plainer than most. Like them, she made liberal financial contributions. Madison House could count on her for an annual donation of about $10,000. But unlike many of the matrons, Bella also began to show an active day-after-day interest in the development of the philanthropy to which she gave money. And as the years went by, the trustees and workers of Madison House became aware that her interest was really in one particular type of development. Bella's concern was not captured by the more philosophical aspects of Settlement House work. She sat back quietly during discussions of lecture content or of the best methods of strengthening ties between immigrant parents and American-born children. But when the discussions turned to the laying out of basketball courts in the backyard of the house, or the creation of a summer camp in the country for slum children, the slim little woman would lean forward, and her fingers would begin to drum restlessly on the table, and her soft voice would begin to inundate the other trustees with a flood of ideas. It was not long before the trustees came to realize that for a gray-haired housewife and mother, Bella Moses had a most unusual interest in physical construction. Behind her spectacles were the eyes of the builder. The eyes could glitter with enthusiasm over the smallest details. When the board agreed to provide living quarters for house staffers, it was Bella Moses who thought of providing the quarters with a lounge so the young men and women could have a place to chat together during their off hours. And it was Bella who went out and found the perfect centerpiece for the lounge, a heavy table 6 feet across, supported by a pedestal instead of legs, so that people could sit around it more easily. When the board decided to set up a temporary summer camp in Pelham Bay Park, it was Bella who thought of putting old rugs under the beds to make the tents warmer. And when, in 1900, Madison House decided to embark on its largest project, the construction of a permanent summer camp, the ideas began to pour out of Bella Moses in a steady stream. The camp was to be built on an old farm in a beautiful valley near Putnam, New York. Bella began to appear at trustees' meetings with proposed layouts of the camp, and then with proposed layouts of interiors of the camp buildings. When the camp was opened, Bella and Emmanuel visited it every weekend during the season. Often they would make the 60-mile trip up from New York with their special friends on the board, Olga and Moritz Kirschberger, and middle-aged bachelor Herman Wolf. When the Kirschbergers and Wolf agreed that it would be nice to spend longer periods in the camp, Bella proposed that they should all chip in and pay for the construction of a summer lodge big enough for two couples and a bachelor. And when the comfortable, solidly built structure was completed, it was Bella who suggested an agreement under which the building would become the camp's property, its residence for teenage girls, when all five owners were dead. In expounding her proposals, Bella was always a lady. She never raised her voice. But veneered only thinly by her excellent manners was a certain aggressiveness, and if there was a prolonged disagreement with her proposals, the veneer could wear thin indeed. When discussing a project in which she was especially interested, Bella had always displayed impatience with other people's ideas, but in her later years on the Madison House board, she seemed more and more unwilling even to consider such ideas, or in fact, to listen to them. Says one house staffer who sat in on board meetings, "In a quiet way, Mrs. Moses could really be quite impatient. She knew what she wanted, and she intended to have it." Says another, "She liked to get things done, and if she had to step on toes to get them done, she'd step on toes." Some of Bella's proposals were based on generalized theories. "You should always buy the best," she would say. Having the best equipment made people respect it and take care of it. Some of the trustees, feeling that Madison House, perennially broke, should economize, were annoyed, but Bella brooked no compromise. When the head worker was furnishing the staff quarters, for example, she instructed him, "Now, there'll be no pictures dragged out of people's closets. Buy pictures, and buy pretty ones." She was convinced also of the importance of symbols. "They were needed," she said, "to give the children a sense of identity. by which she meant a sense that they were part of Madison House. As soon as the camp was opened, she designed a huge Camp Madison banner and hung it in the dining hall. Once Bella got involved in a project, no task was too small for her. Camp counselors saw the slim little matron inspecting the grounds hour after hour. When the inspection disclosed flaws, she was not bashful in bringing them to people's attention. "We had been taught that in social work you should be somewhat permissive," recalls one of the workers. "She wasn't that kind of person. If she saw that the kids weren't cleaning up the bunks properly, she'd say, 'Now get busy, get that bunk cleaned up.' If she came back and it still wasn't clean, she'd say, 'Didn't I tell you to clean it up?' And if her hints didn't bring results, she had more direct methods. If a floor remained unswept too long, she'd grab a broom and sweep it herself. Beds were supposed to be made before breakfast, but one bunk never seemed to get them done in time. One morning, Bella said shortly, 'I'll make them for you,' and did, all 10 of them. When disputes arose among the trustees, there was one vote Bella could always count on. Emmanuel Moses was a member of the board, too, although, as one trustee commented, he was so quiet you'd hardly know it. The trustees came to know Emmanuel as a likable and generous man, but they also learned that his wife did the talking for the Moses family. This was true in the Moses home as well. "The relationship between mother and father was simple," Paul Moses would recall. "Father did what mother directed." If the relationship seemed similar in general to that of Bella's own parents, there were more specific parallels, too. Like Rosalie, Bella had especially strong feelings about religion. She did not believe in it. She did not want her sons to be circumcised, to be bar mitzvah, or to have any training whatsoever in the Jewish faith. She wanted her family to be members of the Society for Ethical Culture. Her husband was more religious, but Bella's feelings were the ones which prevailed, as her mother's had prevailed. When Rosalie had joined the Society for Ethical Culture, Bernard had joined too. When Bella joined the society, so did Emmanuel. Bella Moses' children grew up in snug luxury. The family lived at 20 East 46th Street, just off Fifth Avenue, in the heartland of the German-Jewish elite. The neighborhood was one of lavish private homes. The Seligman house was almost directly across the street from the Moseses, and two doors down lived the Lehmans. Their youngest child, Herbert, was a student at Williams College. It was a neighborhood in which the children all knew one another. They visited one another's homes, so alike, with the varnished oak and black walnut paneling, red damask and green rep, heavy-legged, plump-cushioned sofas, green-fringed lamps, and Dresden figurines. They played together in Central Park, while private tutors stood sentry duty, and the boys wearing white gloves attended Viola Wolf's dancing classes together. The house in which the Moses children were raised, among oak paneling and red damask, was the one in which their mother had lived when she was a girl. When Bernard Cohen died, he had left it to Bella in his will, and when she decided that the Moses family would move back to New York, her mother had been happy to move out of the house and into the suite at the Windsor a block away. The house was a large brownstone, 5 stories and a basement, but there was plenty of money to run it. If the Moseses were not nearly as rich as the Lehmans, the Seligmans, or other grand dukes, such as the Schiffs, they were, in turn-of-the-century terms, rich enough. Between Bella's share of her father's estate and the sale of Emmanuel's New Haven interests, the family had assets of about $1,200,000. Bella was able to command an establishment that included an extremely talented German cook and 3 maids, including a longtime retainer known as Old Annie. The 2 Moses boys slept in custom-made beds, 6 feet 6 inches long, on hair mattresses woven to order by the most famous mattress maker in New York, C.P. Rogers. They slept in the same room again, but adjoining their New York bedroom was their own library study, its walls lined with books. Once Paul counted them. There were more than 2,000. Dinner was served, off the finest Haviland china, in a paneled dining room, along one wall of which stood a tremendous sideboard bearing gleaming crystal decanters. After dinner, the family would repair to the library, whose walls were covered with Rembrandt and Dürer prints, and old Annie would pour coffee from a silver coffee pot into French demitasse cups, each cup a different bright color that cost $24 apiece. In the summer, there were trips to Europe, or Granny Cohen might rent a summer place in Elberon, one of the expensive resort towns along the New Jersey shore that had become known collectively as the Jewish Newport. Granny's house would be much smaller than the Lewisons' Elberon Castle on a hill, of course, but it would be big and roomy. The Moseses wouldn't travel down from New York by private railroad car, as did the Schiffs, but they did have a touring car and chauffeur, and the boys would have a wonderful time. They always had a wonderful time with Granny Cohen. If she had, in the opinion of some, not been overly attentive to her own children, she doted on her grandchildren. Every spring, as soon as the weather turned warm, she would take Robert and Paul on a weekend to Atlantic City, purchasing the railroad tickets by the elbowing method, while the two little boys watched the imperious old lady with awe. After checking into a hotel, with the manager himself showing her to her room, she would take the boys out along the boardwalk and cram their pockets full of tickets to the thrill rides at Young's Pier and Hyler's. And when the boys rode the roller coasters or the loop-the-loop, they would not be unaccompanied. Sitting between them, holding tight to her huge hat, would be Rosalie Silverman Cohen, then in her late 70s, laughing with glee. Bella was strict with her children. Running a taut house, she ordered every aspect of their lives. Their advice was not solicited, even about their own clothes. Once, opening a closet to get their tuxedos for a party, they found that the dress suits had disappeared and new ones had been hung in their places. When they inquired, old Annie explained that their mother had decided that the old ones were no longer suitable. On one visit to Brooks Brothers, Paul asked for a green cap. His mother ordered a red one, for no reason that he could see, except that he had asked for green. Bella was particularly interested in the boys' education. She selected as their tutors young men with outstanding credentials. The boy's favorite, for example, had just returned from Oxford, where he had taken a double first in classics and literary humanities. When Paul was 13, Robert 12, and Edna 9, the children were enrolled in the Ethical Culture School. After 2 years, the boys were transferred to the Dwight School for 2 years, and then were sent to board for a year at one of the most expensive of college preparatory schools, the Mohegan Lake Academy, near Poughkeepsie, before they went on to college, Paul to Princeton, and Robert, who had never forgotten his desire to return to New Haven, to Yale. Even while the boys were at Ethical Culture and Dwight, Bella hired tutors to give them additional instruction, and she furnished still other instruction herself, assigning them books by Lawrence Stern and other of her favorite authors to read, and then holding long discussions with them, and with Edna when she was old enough, about the book's meaning. Casually reading a passage, she would suddenly turn to one of the children and ask, "What's that mean?" And when she asked that, Paul would recall more than half a century later, "You would better know." Even while the children were playing, they were reminded of the importance of good English. If one of them mispronounced a word, down the stairs would come their mother's voice saying, "What was that? What was that?" Edna did not flourish in this atmosphere. An extremely plain, shy girl, she became more and more quiet and withdrawn. But everybody exclaimed over Bella's two boys. Just over a year apart in age, in appearance they might almost have been twins. They were tall, Paul and even 6 feet, Robert an inch taller, and graceful and very slim, although Robert was wiry and strong and had wide shoulders and wrists that hinted at a frame that would one day be powerful. Their height and the darkness of their hair and skin made them resemble their father, but the father's somewhat broad features had been refined in the boys, so that they were stunningly handsome, with high cheekbones and slim, almost aquiline noses to go with full, sensual lips and wide, deep, liquid gray eyes. While the father's skin was dark, the blood of Seville ran even closer to the surface in his son's, making their faces olive-colored, almost swarthy backdrops for smiles that everyone agreed were charming. And where the father's movements were deliberate and calm, theirs were flashing, and the set of their heads was haughty. If Paul was quicker to smile, both boys were equally quick to anger. They had tempers that went with the haughtiness. They looked like two young, handsome, passionate Spanish grandees set down by mistake in the stodgy red damask of 46th Street. And the boys' minds were as remarkable as their looks. Teachers at the schools they attended told Bella, with a unanimity that must have become almost monotonous, that her sons were brilliant. And they were popular, not only with girls, who were attracted by their quick wit as well as by their looks, but with boys with whom they went to school, although Paul was the more popular. Robert was more of a loner. Robert was interested in athletics, but not in sports which required him to be part of a team. He preferred instead gymnastics, swimming, and track, sports in which the athlete competes alone. In track, he chose the loneliest of events, the cross-country run. If the handsome, sparkling brothers made quite a picture in the library after dinner, framed by dark wood and Rembrandts, black-uniformed old Annie hovering behind them with silver service as they chatted with mother, father, and sister over demitasse, the picture was complemented by conversation that was the quick play of quick minds, wit striking fire from wit. If there were no visitors present, Edna joined in. The father, of course, was the outsider. It was not that anyone was actually rude to him, relatives and friends would recall. His family's attitude was, rather, amiably patronizing. In the words of one visitor, it was the kind of thing where, when Emmanuel said something, the kids would good-naturedly say, "Oh, Dad! Oh, Father!" And then they'd go right on with what they had been saying. It was as if everyone, including him, had sort of accepted the fact that he had nothing to contribute. After he moved to New York, Emmanuel Moses did a lot of reading. "Reading," he would often say, "is the solace of old age." Relatives and friends began to notice that within this family circle, an inner circle was forming. It was Robert Moses and his mother. More and more, within the family, they formed a small, increasingly private clique. More and more, it became apparent that Robert was his mother's favorite. This favoritism was expressed with the intensity that characterized everything Bella did. All her children were spoiled, spoiled by maids and cooks and grandmother, spoiled by wealth. But in Robert's case, the spoiling was also done by his mother. Increasingly, Bella Moses began to cater to her younger son's every whim. "You would never think of this word in connection with Bella," one relative says, "but the only word you could use to describe her treatment of Robert was doting." No one was sure of the explanation. Relatives speculated that it was because Bella's slashing, incisive mind had found in Robert a mind with like qualities. Perhaps this was part of the explanation, but it ignored the fact that her other son possessed the same qualities. Perhaps another part of the explanation was that when the family discussions grew especially lively, Robert knew where to stop. On issues about which Bella felt especially strongly, Paul would often disagree with his mother. Robert never did. And Bella Moses, after all, was not a woman who liked to be disagreed with. And part of the explanation, almost certainly, was that Robert tendered his mother the sincerest form of flattery. If Bella cherished the ideal of public service conceived of in idealistic, almost platonic terms, this ideal was becoming the theme of more and more of Robert's conversation, too. More and more, in the after-dinner chats in the library, Robert began to talk about dedicating his life to helping people. The imitation went beyond enunciation of ideals. People who had classified as a manifestation of supreme and deep-rooted arrogance Bella's refusal to be swayed by, or, in later years, even to listen at length to, the opinions of others, now began to notice this same arrogance in Robert. They noticed also that increasingly the rhythms of Robert's voice echoed the sharpness of his mother's sallies. The tall, handsome young man even adopted, consciously or unconsciously, a distinctive pose favored by the graying, bespectacled, plain little woman, an unusual tilt of the head. When a person